From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. On Saturday evening, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team will be at Rio Tinto Stadium in Sandy to take on Mexico in an international friendly match. Today on the program, KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has a conversation with midfielder Megan Rapinoe, who's a leader on the field, but who has also become a leading voice in the LGBT rights movement as an openly gay athlete.
To be able to impact people's lives or give them hope or just make them proud just by being who I am is incredibly humbling, and I love that aspect of coming out and being out and knowing that, you know, some people have someone else to look to on the team that's like them now.
That conversation, your top local headlines and political cornflakes, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up just ahead on the show, a conversation with U.S. Women's National Soccer midfielder Megan Rapinoe. But first up, we have these headlines. Utah Governor Gary Herbert met with Fox News Channel executives in New York City on Thursday as he looks to join the ranks of Republican colleagues like Chris Christie of New Jersey and Scott Walker of Wisconsin, who regularly appear on the network to increase their national exposure and connect with a broader base of supporters. While frequent guests Christie and Walker are considered possible 2016 presidential candidates, Herbert's spokesman says the governor's motivation is to promote Utah, not to prepare a run for higher office. Utah State University political scientist Damon Kahn says Herbert hasn't signaled he'd run for anything other than re-election. Kahn says TV appearances are likely part of Herbert's continued efforts to raise Utah's profile. Herbert appeared twice on Fox News in recent months to discuss immigration and public lands issues. A former county pest control official in central Utah is facing allegations that he skimmed insecticide and resold it, pocketing some $70,000. The retired mosquito abatement director from Sevier County is accused of altering records to make it look like his crews used more bug spray than they actually did, then reselling the extra at a discount. Authorities say 67-year-old John P. Johnson sold the supplies to farmers and other local governments from 2009 until his retirement in 2012. The sheriff says the scheme was discovered when a new director took over. Johnson is facing 11 theft and fraud charges. The Salt Lake Tribune reports Johnson has turned over $100,100 in restitution, and his attorney says a plea deal is in the works. A $5 million quick fix could have a washed-out stretch of Interstate 15 between Las Vegas and Salt Lake City reopened on Friday. Nevada Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meg Ragonisi says it's not certain, but one lane in each direction could be repaired enough to open the freeway near Moapa by the end of the day. Big rig trucks will still be detoured on a roundabout route that adds 50 miles and several hours to their trip. Ragonisi says the repair cost so far is about $5 million. That's on top of a projected $667,000 cost to repair local roads in northeastern Clark County in Nevada. Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval declared a state of emergency after intense rainfall and flash flooding on Monday. Officials report finding 139 flood-damaged homes in the area. Utah's members of Congress are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the creation of Canyonlands National Park. But in doing so, they're calling for something else entirely. To find out more, I spoke with Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
So the Republican members of Utah's delegation sent a letter yesterday to President Barack Obama and Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, saying they're really proud of Canyonlands and how great it is for visitors and what an amazing place it is. But at the same time, the delegation said that Obama and Jewell should endorse a plan by state and local leaders to figure out what to do with the big swath of area around the national park, and that Obama shouldn't just go ahead and name a national monument. Your listeners probably remember the idea that's been touted out there on the Greater Canyonlands National Park, which would preserve 1.8 million acres around the Canyonlands Park. And it's possible that Obama could do that kind of naming of a national monument in the near future. We're not sure when. But Utah's GOP crew says that he should wait while the state and local folks kind of figure out what they want to do in their own backyard.
Okay, so part of the message they're sending is, look, we're proud of the conservation that's been done, but we need to evaluate from the local level what's happening, and you guys shouldn't step on our toes.
Yeah, pretty much. You summed it up in a shorter letter if you wrote it.
Thomas, a follow-up on this is, you know, do we have any indication yet as to whether or not the president will act on this? These declarations are generally surprises, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I try to keep in touch with, you know, officials at all level when it comes to that. And as far as I know, there's no plan coming forward anytime soon. But, you know, those things change. You know, we're in election year. I'm not sure the administration cares really how Utah's elections are going to turn out. So it's a prime area. But then again, you know, they've got other issues they're worried about right now.
Definitely. We'll have to get to some of those further on in this conversation. But speaking of Utah's delegation in Washington, Senator Mike Lee is teaming up with his old pal, Senator Ted Cruz, once again. What's the dynamic duo doing this time?
Yeah, you know, so I guess that does that make Ted Cruz Batman, and that would make Mike Lee Robin, right?
Right, of course.
Well, holy shnikes, Batman. Cruz and Lee sent a letter to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid this week warning that if he calls a lame duck session, which is, you know, the session that Congress would hold after the elections are already done, but before the new Congress starts, that the two senators would vote against or try to block any non-emergency legislation. That means they'll work against anything like, you know, immigration reform, tax reform, or things like treaties or nominations. Their argument is that they think it's unfair that a Congress with members who didn't run lost in their elections should decide the big ticket issues. The problem with that could be, you know, a mess in some ways. The Congress this week and next week are, you know, kind of deciding how it's going to pass a temporary stopgap budget deal that would need to be redone possibly later this fall, this winter. So now we're looking at a situation where we might have another showdown that ends in a shutdown if there's some kind of battle during the lame duck session. You know, it's a good old Washington at work.
Yeah, good old Washington at work indeed. You know, I always have to wonder about how this would look from the flip side. You know, does Mike Lee worry about retribution should the Republicans get control of the Senate and then seeing the same thing happen to him?
You know, I think it's going to be that way no matter what. So there's always the minority always feels like they're not being treated fair. And so, you know, they're always fighting. They're always trying to block things. It, you know, used to be they could get along and pass compromise things. But it's such a dirty word here in this town that who knows if he's even concerned about that.
Yeah, who knows? I guess that's just the nature of the game right now. Thomas, finally, President Barack Obama this week asked Congress for help in his plan to attack and dismantle the so-called Islamic State of Syria and the Levant. How are Utah's members reacting to that?
So your listeners probably watched or listened to the president's address this week, where he called for what's called Title 10 authorization. He's asking Congress for approval of this that would say the Defense Department could train and assist groups like the Syrian opposition to fight against the Islamic jihadists and partner with these other rebel groups to fight ISIL. So far, the Utah delegation is pretty much, you know, taking a wait and see approach. The key phrase around here this week has been no blank checks. They don't want to say, here you go, Obama, good luck. They want this limited, detailed plan on how his authority is going to be used. And I guess we're going to see, the senators are pretty much wanting to see this plan before they say whether they're going to go for it or not. Same with the House members. So we'll see how this goes down. In the end, you'll probably get most of the Utah delegation on board, but there might be a few holdouts.
Well, I guess we'll know shortly. It's an unenviable situation to have to deal with, definitely. Thomas Burr, thanks as always for bringing us up to date on what's happening in Washington.
Thank you, Roger.
And again, that was Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes. He joins us weekly for this conversation, and you can find a link to Political Cornflakes on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. On Saturday evening, the U.S. women's national soccer team will be at Rio Tinto Stadium in Sandy to take on Mexico in an international friendly match. The game is one of a couple in the lead-up to a regional tournament, followed by the Women's World Cup next June. Midfielder Megan Rapinoe figures to be a major part of the U.S. national team in this critical phase. She's already won the gold medal at the 2012 Olympics and helped the U.S. finish second in the 2011 World Cup. But while she's become a leader on the field, Rapinoe has also become a leading voice in the LGBT rights movement as an openly gay athlete. Ahead of her team's match in Utah, KCPW's Ryan Cunningham spoke with Rapinoe over the phone about LGBT issues, the state of women's soccer, and more. Here now is that conversation.
Megan Rapinoe, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to Salt Lake.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I took a look at your Facebook profile before this interview, and I noticed you had a selfie with the Salt Lake LDS Temple. For those of the listeners who don't know, you're an open and active member of the LGBT community. Given some of the LDS positions on same-sex marriage and, you know, other LGBT-related issues, how did it feel walking around Temple Square the other day?
I mean, it felt fine for me. I mean, obviously, I'm aware of not just some of it, but I guess their whole stance on it. It doesn't really bother me. I mean, I don't feel like I'm going to get, you know, mugged by any kind of LDS member or anything. I mean, it's a beautiful sort of area in Salt Lake, and it was cool to see that, and yeah, a little irony in there, of course. But it really was just a beautiful morning and a nice chance to walk around, and I don't think I was bothering anyone just by my presence, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I noticed the caption on the picture was hashtag out and about. So yeah, there was a little irony there. So you came out publicly in 2012. How has your public persona changed since you came out?
I don't know if my persona has changed. I feel like I've sort of always, you know, been publicly pretty open and pretty honest. I think just since 2011 and after the World Cup and after the Olympics, the whole, you know, profile of the team and the players have grown. So I think in one aspect, you say, oh, you came out and then, you know, your public image has gotten bigger and more popular, but I think it's more the fact that the team has done so well, and then, you know, the individuals have taken, you know, their opportunities to be in that spotlight or to say the things that they believe in.
I imagine it's kind of liberating to not have to hide certain aspects of your life. Is it kind of a burden knowing that maybe more eyes are on you now as an example to the LGBT community?
No, it doesn't feel like a burden at all. Definitely not at all. I mean, I feel very strong about what I believe in, and obviously being gay, I just feel strong about being myself. And I don't feel that there's any, you know, pressure to say the right thing or do the right thing. I just have to be me, and that's easy for me. So I don't feel any, if anything, it was the opposite, feeling a burden a different way, but I feel very lucky and very fortunate to be on this team and to be in the platform, you know, to be able to have the platform that we do, to talk about those issues and to inspire people if I can, or just, you know, be someone that people can look to and enjoy the fact that I'm just who I am and I'm out and I'm very proud of that.
How supportive has your team been? Because I know, especially with when Michael Sam was coming to the NFL, a lot of players in the NFL were saying, I don't know if I can handle having a gay player in the locker room. How important is it to have the support of your team members?
I think it's really important. You know, for us, I'm not the only gay player on my team. Whether, you know, some people are out or some people aren't, I think that in women's sports it's much different. I've you know, been gay since I've been on the team, so I think it wasn't anything new. And they've been very supportive of me coming out and saying that publicly, and definitely supported me along the way. You know, for men, obviously, it's different. For the players that wonder if they can handle a gay player being in their locker room are just like so full of themselves. Like, don't flatter yourself. You're going to be fine. You need to focus on what's going on the field and focus on your job and not be so caught up in, oh, am I going to be able to handle the gay player? I mean, they're not thinking about you, so don't think that.
Have people come up to you? Have fans come up to you? And what have they said to you about your decision to come out? How has it felt to hear those things?
I mean, they're all positive, really. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there that disagree with it, but it's humbling every time, you know, someone comes up to me and just either thanks me for doing what I'm doing or, you know, just shows appreciation for it. Even, you know, members of our fans that aren't gay or lesbian, they're so thankful that I've done what I've done and creating a good example. And I think that it's something that is really special to me. That's something that I didn't really realize would have such an impact on me, but to be able to, you know, just impact people's lives or give them hope or, you know, just make them proud just by being who I am is incredibly humbling. And I love that aspect of coming out and being out and knowing that, you know, some people have someone else to look to on the team that's like them now.
Would you say you're a different person now?
No, I'm a different person. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm always, I guess you're always evolving as you get older and feeling more confident and feeling more comfortable in yourself. I'm definitely more comfortable in my own skin. I wouldn't say I was ever uncomfortable, but, you know, I think that I've really, you know, enjoyed being out and being able to have a voice and being able to be a strong voice in this issue and in this fight for gay rights and gay marriage and, you know, equality in sport and equality just across the board. I think that I've really enjoyed, you know, being given the platform to do that.
You recently got to guest edit a magazine called Washington Blade. Can you describe what that magazine is and then what you got to do there?
Yeah, it's a LGBTQ publication out of D.C. They do a lot of sports things, and so they've kind of approached me. I actually Ghost wrote that article with Laura Clace, who's an amazing activist out of D.C. It was really fun to do that and to kind of look at, you know, the LGBTQ struggle from a different sense. And for me, I mean, I don't know if all gay people feel this way, but for me, I do feel like we need allies and straight allies and gay allies. And I think that it's important to bring everybody in on this issue. And I think sometimes it's hard for straight people to, you know, feel like their voice is heard, but it is and it's needed. And that's the reality of the situation, I believe. I think that we definitely need, you know, strong gay members of the community leading the charge. But I think that the more people that are interested in this issue and the more people that are passionate about this issue, the better.
I'm going to make an abrupt change of subject now. Let's talk about the World Cup next year. The Women's World Cup is going to be played in Canada, and it's going to be played on an entirely artificial turf. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm part of the group that has filed a lawsuit against FIFA and against the CSA to try to change it, so I don't feel very, very good about that.
Can you describe why artificial turf doesn't quite work for soccer players? Because there are a lot NFL is played on a lot of artificial turfs, but it's a little different game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard on your body. We're playing, you know, hopefully 6-7 games in a matter of 3 weeks. That's incredibly hard on your body, plus the travel, plus the training on the turf as well. You know, it doesn't have as much give. There's more injuries on turf. There's more, you know, superficial injuries, just scrapes and burns. You know, it is more dangerous to play, and it does change the way that you play, you know, with that risk of injury that you're having. I think that it's in the back of your mind. I mean, just performance-wise, you know, from a technical standpoint, the ball bounces different, skips higher. The bounce is never true. The ball bubbles up when you dribble the ball. You can't chip the ball. I mean, there's just an innumerable amount of things. There's a reason why we're having this issue, and there's a reason why we're having this fight, and there's a reason why the Men's World Cup would never even be thought of to play on turf and most of the men's games, you know, across the world, if it's possible to play on a grass field, then that's optimal.
Yeah, why make this change for such a major tournament for women's soccer when it would never even be a thought for a men's soccer tournament?
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate question, I think. Why is FIFA allowing this to happen? Why are they not willing, at least at this point, to make a change, which, you know, for the amount of money, it would basically be a drop in the hat for them.
Is there any argument to be made about the technology of artificial turf now that it's good enough to the point where it would work out?
No, I don't think so, because they're not making that argument for the men's game.
Okay. So you've played club and national soccer and all around the world. How well is women's soccer received in different parts of the world? Is it received differently from men's soccer, obviously?
It is. I mean, obviously, you know, go to Europe, that's the biggest leagues in the world. It's not as popular as there. But I think after the World Cup and the Olympics, this last cycle, it's just growing by the day. I think you can see, you know, just within the clubs, they're putting more money into their women's team, and they're putting more emphasis on being successful in their women's teams. I think you can look at the games, the internationals that we play and other teams play, you know, many more fans than we had ever gotten before, especially abroad. But I think it's really growing, and I think, you know, this World Cup will be a good showcase and keep building on what we had in Germany in 2011.
In the U.S., it's been a really big benefit for the men's Major League Soccer just because of the men's national team and their success in a World Cup. Mm-hmm. But ironically, the women's national team has always been very good. They've won 2 World Cups. And yet women's pro leagues have really struggled to survive. What are the obstacles for women's soccer? Are they different than for men's soccer?
In ways, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, when the MLS started, they had, you know, basically a group of investors with sort of endless pockets. And that's really, I think, something that we struggled with is just finding the funding and finding the sponsorships and finding the people willing to lose money for years on end, you know, in order to achieve a greater vision, which takes time. I think that we're getting there. I think that the business model for this new league is much better than last year. And I think that we're spending money in the right ways and saving money in the right ways. But it does. It takes a lot of money, and it takes a lot of people passionate enough and willing to lose money, but knowing that if you do it right and if you do make this investment now, there is a possibility to make money. And there is definitely a platform and a demand for the league that we have.
I saw the salary cap for teams in the current women's league is about $200,000 per team.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get players to commit to playing for a team that usually has about 20 players and they know they're not going to get a very good salary?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's definitely tough. You know, you have to create an environment that the players, you know, feel appreciated in, and an environment where the players can get better. And some players aren't making that much money. But, you know, they're able to live in the city that they want to live in, or, you know, be coached by a coach that they feel like will make them better. It is tough, though. You know, that is definitely the struggle. It's like, how long can players sustain, you know, not being paid very much money? And, you know, I know that, you know, not all the teams spend all of their salary cap, which is unfortunate. I feel like if you have it, you know, you have to invest in your players. But eventually that will grow, and we'll be able to pay players more and, you know, pay them more closely to what they're worth.
We don't have a whole lot of time left, but I just want to ask you generally, what drew you to soccer?
My older brother played soccer growing up, and I have a twin sister, and so we just kind of wanted to do everything that he did initially. And then once we started playing, I think that was it. We just loved it. You know, it was never a fight to get us to practice or to go to the games. It's just something that we caught on to and latched on to and have loved ever since.
Is there still kind of a rivalry between your siblings and especially your twin sister?
Not too much. We always play different positions. So it wasn't really a direct rivalry between us. I mean, we would definitely have our battles, but we always played on opposite ends of the field.
Did you have influences growing up, famous players that you really liked?
In terms of soccer players, I mean, soccer's so much more available now. I wish that we had that kind of access when I was younger. But, I mean, obviously the women's national team, that was sort of the main, you know, outlet that we had to watch in the World Cup. And I went to the World Cup in 94, the Men's World Cup, and then went to the Women's World Cup in 99, saw those players. A lot of my favorite sports players aren't soccer players. You know, Michael Jordan growing up was one of my idols. I had his pictures kind of plastered all over my walls, but these kids now have so much more access to have, you know, women's stars and men's stars, and they can watch games all the time, which is brilliant.
Yeah, women's stars like Megan Rapinoe, maybe.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, thank you so much, Megan Rapinoe. I really appreciated having the time to talk with you, and good luck against Mexico tomorrow.
All right, thank you so much.
And again, that was KCBW's Ryan Cunningham in conversation with Megan Rapinoe, a player with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. You can see her and the entire U.S. national team in action at Rio Tinto Stadium on Saturday at 7:30 p.m. They'll be up against continental rival Mexico. To hear this interview or past interviews of The Rundown, check out our podcast on iTunes or visit kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning in this afternoon. Our show was produced by yours truly and Ryan Cunningham, with additional help from Ross Chambliss. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Monday on the program, tune in for a conversation about the Mountain Accord, a collaborative effort which hopes to chart the future of Utah's central Wasatch Mountains. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.